and I also represented him on a direct appeal and throughout the post-conviction proceedings. This case is boiled down now in post-conviction proceedings to a very simple issue regarding ineffective assistance of counsel. After the direct appeal came out and there was a dissenting opinion, I mean, the difference between the majority and the dissenting opinion was whether or not a sufficient foundation had been laid for the blood evidence and whether Mr. Brownlow's right to confrontation was denied by using a hearsay listing of where the blood evidence came from, and whether his, to follow up on that, whether his counsel then invited error by not objecting to certain things, as there was certain testimony regarding these hearsay documents as they were happening, and or forgetting to object to some of the rewritten documents. There's four exhibits at issue here. There's Exhibit 29, which is the original listing of the blood evidence from Mr. Smith, and Mr. Smith is the investigator who passed away prior to the trial. To just back up a minute and remind the court, this is a cold case. It happened almost 30 years before the defendant was, defendant's DNA hit in CODIS and was therefore arrested. When the defendant went to trial, he was a man in his 40s. When this crime happened, he was a boy who had only just turned 16, and the victim was his classmate, who was also, she was only 15, so they were very similar in age. So the blood evidence is critical here, because without the blood evidence matching the DNA of Troy Brownlow, there's no other evidence to tie him to this crime scene except a partial fingerprint on the faucet in the bathroom near the bedroom where the body was found. And he was a friend of the victim and her older sister. There's reasons why he could have been in that house sooner. So that by itself is not sufficient evidence to convict him of a homicide without the blood evidence. So going back to the blood evidence, Exhibit 29 is the list in the deceased detective's handwriting, noting where he collected all the blood samples from and, you know, marking them so someone could go back later and say, well, this vial was from the headboard, this vial was from the bathroom, this vial was from the hallway, et cetera, et cetera. The district court rule, or excuse me, the district court, what happened in the district court is complicated and really doesn't matter now, because exhibit number 29 was never actually admitted into evidence at trial. The Court of Appeals held that Exhibit 29 was clearly testimonial hearsay. However, it was never admitted into evidence, but it was quoted from several prosecution witnesses. Kind of the key exhibit, though, is Exhibit 31. Exhibit 31 was prepared from the handwritten Exhibit 29, and it's a basically, it's just Exhibit 29 taken to a secretary and then typed up and then signed by Mr. Smith and submitted to the CBI. So it contains the identical information as Exhibit 29, but it's typed and signed and submitted to CBI. Trial counsel forgot to object to that exhibit. They did not object to that exhibit. And in the 35C motion, and there was no evidentiary hearing, so my proffer there is undisputed. Had there been an evidentiary hearing, trial counsel would have testified that there was no strategic reason for failing to object to the admissibility of Exhibit 31 on confrontation grounds. They merely forgot during the heat of battle when everything was happening so quickly. The Court of Appeals on direct appeal declined to rule whether or not Exhibit 39 was
31.
Excuse me, whether Exhibit 31 was testimony or hearsay because of the failure to object and preserve that issue, which is why, instead of going straight to federal court on a writ of habeas corpus, I first tried to plug in the holes here and establish that these various mistakes were ineffective assistance of counsel first before going to federal court. The other two exhibits, exhibits 48 and 14, something similar, a handwritten sketch made at the crime scene, kind of showing the layout of the rooms, and there were some mistakes on it. And then exhibit 14 is kind of the redrawn, prettied up version made from exhibit 48. By itself, exhibit 48 And the rewritten version, Exhibit 14, would not be enough to have violated Mr. Brownlow's right to confrontation. The Court of Appeals ruled that Exhibit 48, the sketch of the crime scene by itself, was non-testimonial, and that's not really an issue left in this case.
Well, let's take the analysis that the division in the direct appeal used and apply it to Exhibit 31, which is what you're concerned about, right?
Exactly.
So if admission of a sketch does not trigger testimonial hearsay concerns, what is the difference between that and Exhibit 31?
Well, because Exhibit 31 isn't a sketch. Exhibit 31 is the retyped up version of Exhibit 29. Exhibit 29 is the key exhibit here. Exhibit 29 wasn't entered into evidence in the trial court, but the retyped up version of it was. And Exhibit 31 would have been ruled testimonial hearsay had defense counsel not forgotten to object to it. That's why there was ineffective assistance of counsel. And then had the objection to Exhibit 31 been properly preserved in the trial court, the majority on direct appeal then could not have sidestepped that issue, and they would have been squarely confronted with the fact, well, now do we have to reverse and remand for a new trial? Instead, they were able to say, well, you invited this error by not objecting to it, and defense counsel invited this error then by allowing various prosecution witnesses to testify from it.
Well, but the division didn't actually rule on it, just said we're not going to address the issue.
Exactly. But had the issue been properly preserved in the district court, with trial counsel objecting to it and making that objection, the Court of Appeals would have not been able to rule in that matter. And then we would have gotten to where the dissent gets. It's like, you can't, if Exhibit 29 is testimonial hearsay, then Exhibit 31 also has to be testimonial hearsay because it's the exact same document. There's nothing new on it. It wasn't created by a different witness. It was just the typed up version of that testimonial hearsay. And then the DA, in order to try to get around the testimonial hearsay problem, just had his witnesses testify from Exhibit 31 instead of Exhibit 29.
Well, they testified from it, but didn't they also say that it was correct and accurate? Didn't they put themselves at issue, so to speak, in saying, I was there, the detective who was... the supervisor was there, correct?
He wasn't able to say that the whole exhibit was correct and accurate because he could remember each place where the blood was drawn.
I think there was one he couldn't remember.
That's why we need an evidentiary hearing here in order to be able to put that Detective Wilborn back on the stand and say, okay, now without looking at Exhibit 29 to refresh your memory, because you can't use that, you only testified from Exhibit 31, can you remember?
Why couldn't you use the exhibit to refresh your recollection?
Because, again, that just is another way to get around the confrontation clause.
Well, it may be getting around it, but if it does refresh his recollection, you could certainly cross-examine on that. But if he were to say, yes, it does refresh my recollection, I remember now where these samples came from, you have the opportunity to confront him on it.
But we haven't had that hearing yet, so we're just guessing what might have happened. I mean, the discrete issue in this appeal is whether the district court erred in denying the 35C motion without an evidentiary hearing so we can establish these various kind of loose ends here before we can finally definitively rule on whether Mr. Brownlow is entitled to a new trial because of these confrontation clause issues.
I can jump in for a moment, sure. I'd like to address the prejudice prong, counsel. And isn't it true that there were other blood samples that were properly admissible in court? So why does this make a difference?
Well, again, that's why we need an evidentiary hearing. There's blood samples all over the house. One of the problems here is there's an alternate theory of how this murder happened, and that is that Mr. Brownlow could have just been a second victim of an adult attacker. His blood does not appear anywhere on the victim's body or on the waterbed or on her clothes, and the only blood that they were able to get from him was a smeared sample from the headboard.
Well, but the evidence that you're saying was improperly admitted wouldn't have answered that question one way or the other.
Well, once we can figure out at the evidentiary hearing what Detective Wilborn can remember and what he can't, so what blood samples we're left with and what we have, then we will know exactly how many blood samples we have and what it can demonstrate. If all the blood samples, for example, from the hallway are excluded, then the prosecution has a real problem. But so much of this evidence came from Exhibit 29, that's why the dissent said, there's plain error here on confrontation grounds, and we have to reverse and remand for a new trial. And my point here on this 35C, before we go to the United States District Court and risk a federal judge agreeing with the dissent here, it would be better practice here to have an evidentiary hearing and give both sides the opportunity to establish exactly what Detective Wilborn can remember and what he can't, and then what blood evidence we have that's left after that determination is made, and whether that's enough so that there could be prejudice as a result, or maybe there's harmless error as a matter of law. But we can't establish that when we keep guessing as to what Detective Wilborn might or might not remember. That's why, in this case, it was error to not hold the evidentiary hearing before we jump to the ultimate conclusion here as to whether there was harmless error as a matter of law. We need to hold the evidentiary hearing and at least hear again from Detective Wilborn what would have happened had trial counsel not forgotten to object to Exhibit 31 at trial. He thought he had preserved that objection for appeal, but forgot to do so. I would like to reserve the rest of my time if the court has no further questions at this time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. In this case, the victim was brutally murdered. She was stabbed to death in 1980, and nearly 25 years later, the cold case was solved when a DNA match identified the defendant. It's unfortunate, but not altogether surprising, that one of the three investigators who collected the evidence at the scene had died in the intervening 25 years. What is perhaps surprising is that the other two investigators who were present at the scene and collected evidence were available and were able to authenticate such evidence. I'd note that it was not only the blood samples that established the defendant's presence at the scene and his fingerprint found there, but also his own statements made to the Rocky Mountain News after he was arrested, saying that he was in fact present at the scene. So that was also evidence which established his presence. Now, on direct appeal, one of the three issues was whether an evidence list prepared by the now deceased investigator was properly admitted at trial. That's Exhibit 29. And in this post-conviction appeal, the defendant maintains that his counsel ineffectively assisted him by failing to object to the second evidence list, which is Exhibit 31. And I think that there's no reason to have an evidentiary hearing regarding this claim of ineffective assistance of counsel based on the conclusions of law in the direct appeal, specifically with regard to that whether there was sufficient foundation for the blood evidence without Smith's list. So the question before this court is really not confrontation so much as authentication. And on direct appeal, the majority concluded none of the testimonial hearsay was necessary as a foundation for other evidence. That's page one of the opinion. The panel also concluded Brownlow identifies no specific physical evidence, and our review of the record has revealed none for which the list was the sole foundation. Now, I set forth in my brief, I think what's most important in this case are the 11 blood samples, which when tested showed a match to varying degrees of scientific certainty to the defendant. The most important of these are the three, which showed to a degree of reasonable degree of scientific certainty that they were the defendant's blood. And I set forth how each of those were properly authenticated by the other two witnesses who had been at the scene. There were then 8 other blood samples which matched the defendants to varying degrees of scientific certainty. I did an exhaustive review of those 8 instances. I set forth in my brief that I found only out of 1 of the 8 did there not seem to be a positive identification of one of the other 2 witnesses that he had seen the sample collected. So with regard to where we are on a prejudice prong, I believe the answer is clearly based on the trial record and the opinion rendered by the other panel of this court on direct appeal that there cannot have been prejudice to the defendant for a failure to object to Exhibit 31, because the prejudice would have to be that the blood evidence was not admitted, the foundation for the blood evidence, but this court clearly found on direct appeal that the evidence was otherwise admissible, and a review of the trial record shows that, and for that reason, no evidentiary hearing is necessary.
What about opposing counsel's argument that there was no ability to test Detective Wilburn's memory at a hearing in this case, and she ought to be entitled to do that?
Well, Your Honor, there were, in fact, at least 2 opportunities to test Captain Wilburn's memory. The first was in the pretrial hearing related to Exhibit 29, and then the second was a trial itself, where clearly his memory could be tested by means of defense cross-examination with regard to his memory of the evidence being collected at the scene. So I would definitely disagree with that, and I would say that the record of the trial shows the defense's full opportunity to cross-examine him.
And was he effectively cross-examined on that?
Yes, actually, Your Honor. I believe that counsel was able to bring out points where he did and didn't remember. And for example, in my analysis of the 8 blood samples, which were matched to the defendant but less than complete scientific certainty, Captain Wilburn testified he did not recall being present when the blood sample on the backyard fence was taken. Now, I think that the backyard fence blood sample is not really all that important in light of the other 10 blood samples. And the other thing is that the other 10 blood samples were much more conclusive evidence against the defendant. Now, in terms of the performance prong, as I said, I believe that clearly the prejudice prong establishes that the defendant is not entitled to relief. But in terms of the performance prong, while the post-conviction motion alleged that counsel forgot to object to Exhibit 31, the motion also alleged that counsel felt that further confrontation objections would be futile because the court had in its pretrial ruling said that Exhibit 29 would be admissible. So for that reason, there could be reasons why competent counsel could clearly decide, because they felt that a further objection would be futile, that no objection need be made at that time. The other thing, while it's my position that the majority got it right in terms of the foundation for the admission of blood evidence, it's clearly my position now, as it was on direct appeal, that the list prepared by Joe Smith did not constitute testimonial hearsay. And my reason for thinking so is that the key question for determining whether a statement is testimonial under Crawford is whether the declarant intends to bear testimony against the accused. Now here, Smith did not intend to offer testimony against the accused when he prepared those lists. He prepared the first list, the list of items collected at the scene, on September 4th, 1980. It was later that same week, I believe it was on September 8th of 1980, that he prepared the second list, which was the list of items that were submitted to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation the first time. So he created both those lists as a ministerial task. And my position, although the panel on direct appeal did not agree with me, my position was and remains that this constitutes a business records exception to the hearsay rule and not testimonial hearsay.
It seems to run directly contrary to what the Supreme Court has said constitutes testimonial hearsay, doesn't it? Police reports? Police requests? those kinds of things? Aren't they almost always testimonial?
Well, I'm trying to think, Your Honor. I mean, our seminal case involves testing of a blood alcohol sample, doesn't it? Where it would be the sample of a particular defendant. And I think that most police reports involve a particular defendant who has been identified. So not observations of the scene, but investigation concerning defendant. And here we have no particular investigation of defendant.
Well, that would make anything preliminary to identifying a suspect non-testimonial. And surely that's not what the Supreme Court meant in Crawford.
I'm trying to think of, as I said, the language of Crawford is to bear testimony against the accused.
But I mean, would a reasonable person expect that what they said or what they put down would be used in a court of law?
I think if we look at it broadly in preparation of litigation, and I believe that phrase has been used, then various procedures undertaken by the police would constitute testimonial hearsay. But this, as I said, is a ministerial task of collecting and recording the evidence. And I don't think that it's intended to bear testimony against the accused in the same way that some investigative activities are intended to do so. I don't have a lot to say about the other exhibit at issue here, Exhibit 14. Here, we have an exhibit that was authenticated by Captain Wilborn as representative of the scene as he observed it, and thus it was properly admitted on that basis, and the trial court record supports that. It was also created by another individual, Deputy Robert Hutchins. So while it's not important with a photograph or a crime scene diagram that the author authenticates it, that was also done in this case. So I don't think there's a problem at all with the admission of Exhibit 14. Moreover, to the extent that Exhibit 14 had its basis, Smith's drawings in Exhibit 48, the Court of Appeals, the other panel on direct appeal, concluded that those were properly admitted because they did not constitute testimonial hearsay. So there's just no way that Exhibit 14 was improperly admitted. Thus, counsel did not render deficient performance by failing to object to Exhibit 14, nor did counsel, was there any resulting prejudice from counsel's actions. Since there was no prejudice, the exhibit was properly admitted. If this court has no further questions, I think, as counsel has said, that the crux of this 35C is Exhibit 31, the prepared list submitted to CBI, that the only possible prejudice that's been stated is that admission of the list would prejudice the defendant because it involved the authentication of the blood samples. But clearly the blood samples were otherwise authenticated by the witnesses who testified at trial. And for that reason, the defendant's claim on 35C regarding Exhibit 31 fails for the same reason that the claim regarding Exhibit 29 failed on direct appeal. I'd ask you to affirm the trial court's order. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not going to address the Attorney General's testimonial hearsay argument that Exhibits 29 and 31 are really business records objections unless the court has some questions regarding that. I would respectfully submit that any such conclusion would be an unreasonable application of clearly established United States Supreme Court precedent. Regarding Mr. Brownlow's statements to the Rocky Mountain News, that's just another paper tiger that has been erected just to strike down. There was never any dispute that Mr. Brownlow was at the scene. His admission to the Rocky Mountain News that he was at the scene is nothing new, nothing surprising, and would not be enough to establish that he committed this crime as a matter of law. There's, like I said, there's this alternate theory that he was the second victim by an adult perpetrator, and that adult perpetrator should have left other types of DNA other than blood from skin peeling off, you know, microscopic particles of skin peeling off on the speakers and on the various articles of clothing that were carefully laid over the victim's body. The Colorado Justice Review Project 2 is contemplating whether or not they're going to test those objects to see if the DNA of a third party can be found, and those test results are not available yet, and that will be a whole separate 35C for newly discovered evidence if and when that happens. So still, this issue before this court is ineffective assistance of counsel regarding failure to object to the exhibits. Regarding the Attorney General's arguments regarding the performance prong of the Strickland test, again, that's something that cannot be determined without an evidentiary hearing. The Attorney General is asking this court to speculate that perhaps competent counsel could have had a legitimate reason not to object because they felt that further objections would be futile. But that's not the point. They didn't say that with respect to Exhibit 31. Mr. Pope said that with respect to Exhibit 29, that he thought additional objections would be futile, and he flat out forgot to object to Exhibit 31. That was the issue of fact that was tendered in the 35C. That is uncontradicted. Therefore, if there's some sort of alternate theory regarding the performance prong, that has to be litigated at an evidentiary hearing before this court can make findings of fact and conclusions of law regarding that. And again, going back to the prejudice prong and whether there was harmless error as a result of any confrontation clause violation, again, the dissent lays out five reasons why that's not true on page 31 of the opinion on direct appeal. And for those five reasons, again, I'm not going to read them, but if this court wants to go back and read Justice Rivera's five reasons as to why there was not constitutional harmless error, that's why there was prejudice in this case. That's why it fell below the standard of care to forget to object, and why Mr. Brownlow was prejudiced, and why had trial counsel not forgotten, the direct appeal would have gone differently, and it would have been reversed and remanded for a new trial. And I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.